The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Hello, everyone. We are starting off in the relationships section. Is your family toxic? Here's how to know if it might be time to cut them out of your life. And this article is by Sophia Lodato. Some lucky people are born into families they love spending time with. Their close bonds make holidays and multi-generational vacations a drama-free joy. But for others, simply seeing an incoming call from a parent triggers anxiety that dates back to childhood, and they leave family gatherings feeling hurt, angry, or exhausted. Toxic family dynamics can have a far-reaching impact on our lives as adults. That said, it can be tricky to recognize when you're in a toxic situation, and even trickier to figure out how to navigate it. Here are signs of a toxic family member, and expert advice on dealing with a toxic family, because drink all of the wine is not a sustainable plan. They play the blame game. One of the biggest signs of toxicity is the inability to take any kind of accountability, shares Morgan Pummels, MSW, RSW. A parent, sibling, or other family member may often place blame for anything that's wrong on someone else, you included. While their actions or behavior may not be the sole reason for a given issue, refusing to take any accountability is a red flag. That lack of accountability, per Pummels, is rooted in an attempt to displace and offload somebody's shame or bad feelings about themselves so they don't have to apologize. Conversely, the ability to apologize, to own your stuff, is a hallmark sign of a healthy family system, she shares. They're masters of the passive-aggressive. Another common sign is passive-aggressive behavior, says Pummels. This can include guilt trips, backhanded compliments, or subtle jabs and digs that no one in the room actually calls out, she says. It can even be nonverbal, like rolled eyes or a disapproving sigh. No one has known you longer than your family has, which means they have a rich back catalog of personal failures to draw from when commenting on your life. Even if they insist they're just teasing, those comments may, subconsciously or not, be disseminating by design. They use fear, obligation, or guilt. My clients often struggle when parents use the concept of FOG, fear, obligation, and guilt, to try to get their child to act a certain way, says Pummels. This manipulative behavior can be anything from intimidating you, threatening you with punishment, or guilting you by saying something like, "You're not a good kid if you don't do this." Being subject to those sorts of tactics can make you feel hopeless, powerless, and full of dread, and as is the design can make you do or say things you are uncomfortable with. They ignore boundaries. Setting healthy boundaries is crucial in healthy relationships. It can range from something simple as, "Please don't call me at work," to asking other family members to respect the rules that you set for your kids. If someone doesn't think the boundaries apply to them, they'll breach them. And that's a blatant show of disrespect. They gaslight you. A term inspired by the 1944 Ingrid Bergman film Gaslight. Gaslighting is a form of emotional abuse, in which someone causes the victim to doubt their own understanding of reality. In other words, your family will deny that any abuse is actually happening, whether it's a sibling insisting your childhood experiences weren't as bad as you remember, or someone point-blank saying, "That didn't happen, you're making things up, as usual." This is where being in a community, fostering healthy relationships with people, and finding a therapist is really important, says Pummels. It's not until someone really mirrors that gaslighting behavior back to you that you can hear that it's not an appropriate response. They use threats, harsh language, or violence. This may seem like the most obvious sign of toxic relationship, but not if it's always been normalized as part of your family dynamic. There's never any situation in which name-calling or physical intimidation and other forms of domestic violence are justified. And if you fear for your safety, help is available. The psychological impact. Dysfunctional family dynamics warp your whole sense of self-worth, says Pummels. If you grow up in dysfunction and continue to live in it, it can feed these beliefs that you aren't good enough or that people don't really love or care for you and never will. You may also find yourself seeking out relationships that reflect the same dynamics and dysfunction. You might find partners who treat you the same way, or who demonstrate some of those qualities that your dysfunctional family demonstrated because it feels familiar. Recognizing the dysfunction. It can be hard, especially in the absence of physical or financial abuse, to recognize that a relationship is dysfunctional. But a hugely effective tool, says Pummels, is getting more in touch with your body. Your body is going to be the thing that says, "I don't like that," or "This doesn't feel good," or "I don't actually want to go to the family dinner," she says. Instead of repressing or ignoring, get in touch with the sensations of your body. If there's a tightness in your chest, you can't breathe well, or you're physically shaking while you're on a phone call with your parents, take note. How to be slippery. Some parents or family members are constantly looking to bait you into conflict with hurtful words. Pummel recommends acting as slippery as possible. In other words, practicing short, evasive, and non-committal responses to these upsetting comments. Even just saying something like, "That's interesting," or "Cool," works. Anything where you're not getting caught up in friction, she says. Notice that it's not an attempt to change anyone else's behavior, but rather to control our own. When to repair and when let go. It's a hard decision to cut off contact with your loved ones, but Pummels points out that certain situations require it, especially when previous attempts to improve relations are unsuccessful. While it can be hard to draw an indelible no-contact line, Pummels recommends going no contact if there is flagrant physical, financial, and/or emotional abuse. At that point, no contact is probably necessary, she says. But it does have to be a decision you come to on your own, or it simply won't stick. Deciding to enforce a no-contact rule is a big move that may test your resolve. Call for new family holiday traditions and spur other family members to try and intervene. It's certainly not the sole option for every turbulent family bond, nor is it the right option for everyone. But it also doesn't have to be permanent, especially because dysfunctional family systems can be repaired. There needs to be a third party, says Pummels, whether that's a trusted community member or a family therapist you can connect with. With toxic families, it's so easy to get swept away rather than sticking to what actually needs to happen in order for there to be repair. Radically accepting. If you don't want to entirely cut off your family, then it's important not only to manage your expectations, but to be radically honest with yourself about who your family is. The biggest piece is acceptance, says Pummels. We're not looking to go there and change the system. Instead, we're just trying to get through the day. It's certainly not easy, but radically accepting allows you to be present for the moments of joy that can come with family, rather than being angry, resentful, or trying to get your parents or siblings to change. Over in wellness, tips for caring for a loved one with schizophrenia. One determined mother shares her own coping skills and her strategies for being an effective caregiver. This article is by A.J. Hanley. When Yvonne DeQueen's son was diagnosed with schizophrenia in early 20s, it came as a complete surprise. The middle child of three sons, Samir always had a great, fun personality, says Queen, an office coordinator for a healthcare network in New Jersey. He was charming and charismatic, the life of the party. There were signs that her son was struggling, however. His business had been hit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, and he'd recently gone through a breakup. I didn't hear from him for 2 months, which was unusual, says Queen. When they finally spoke, she began to notice some impulsive behavior which troubled her. Samir told her he had sold the truck he used for work and given up his townhouse, explaining that he just didn't want them anymore. Her concerns mounted when he moved back home. Samir was disheveled, and he looked like he hadn't showered or shaved in a while, she recalls. He also slept all day while she was at work. She first thought he was on drugs. When that proved not to be the case, Queen ascribed her son's behavior to depression and urged him to talk to someone. Things escalated a few weeks later. Samir ran into my bedroom around 2 a.m. and told me to get out of the house because they were coming to kill me, she says. I kept asking who they were, but he couldn't tell me. After soothing his fears and sending him back to bed, she was awakened an hour later by her mother, who had just received a disturbing call from Samir. When Queen went to his room, she found him naked and cowering in a corner. He kept yelling, "Get away from me! You're trying to kill me!" she says. It was heartbreaking. Worried her son might harm himself, Queen reached out for help to her brother, who was a policeman. Samir was taken to a crisis center for evaluation and then to a mental health facility, where he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. But the man who returned home 3 weeks later was unrecognizable. Withdrawn and incoherent, he could barely eke out a full sentence, Queen says. I knew I had to figure out what was going on with him. Before that could happen, Samir had another, even more serious episode. He had taken off his clothes and was running up and down the street. Unable to calm him down, Queen was forced to call the police, which she admits made her feel embarrassed and ashamed. "We just don't talk about these things, you know," she recalls. Feelings of guilt crept in as well. "I wondered, was it me or something I did? You go through all these different emotions, and then you just have to get to work," she says. "I had to accept the reality that this was my new normal." This roller coaster of emotions is common among caregivers of a loved one with schizophrenia. Affecting up to an estimated 2.4 million adults in the United States, the chronic brain disorder impacts how a person thinks, feels, and behaves. It's believed to be caused by genetic and environmental factors, but life stressors may play a role in the onset of symptoms and their course. Adults living with schizophrenia may experience hallucinations and delusions, as well as social withdrawal, disordered thinking, and a lack of motivation. With this new normal, Queen knew she needed to find the right treatment plan for her son. This included learning everything she could about available treatment options, including long-acting injectables, LAIs, and leveraging her contacts with the healthcare industry to get the best care possible for Samir. Eventually, she was introduced to Invega Sustenna. That's spelled I-N-V-E-G-A. And the second word is S-U-S-T-E-N-N-A. A paliperidone palmitate, a once-monthly ALI option from Johnson & Johnson, J&J. That is among a more recent group of treatment options for adults living with schizophrenia. Unlike oral schizophrenia medications, LAIs offer less frequent dosing options, and that can help patients stay on track with their medication management over time, since they are professionally administered treatments. There are even additional LAI options from J&J that adults can receive every 3 or 6 months, such as Invega Trinza, that second word is spelled T-R-I-N-Z-A, paliperidone palmitate 3 month, and Invega Hefyera, H-A-F-Y-E-R-A, a paliperidone palmitate 6 month. The longest dosing interval options available, which may be options for appropriate patients over time. We tried a few things and they weren't working, Queen recalls, but then landing on Invega Sustenna made all the difference to her son. Soon Samir started communicating again, talking in full sentences. Even though Samir was responding well to his current medication, Queen recalls that getting him on treatment still took a collective effort. I was grateful for a good set of doctors and social workers that came together, and they supported starting and keeping Samir on Invega Sustenna, Queen says. Today, Queen says Samir is seeing tremendous progress, and he now lives in a residential treatment facility that equips him with the right level of support he needs. As his advocate, Queen continues to support her son emotionally and serve as a liaison for his medical care. But it's been a journey. Here she shares her hard-worn advice for navigating a loved one's care. Do your research. The more you know, the better equipped you'll be to support someone with schizophrenia. Queen did a deep dive, reading everything she could about the condition and making calls to various doctors along with friends and colleagues. She also looked to organizations like the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, for educational programs and resources aimed at individuals with schizophrenia and their families. Stay on top of treatments. Perhaps the most important responsibility for caregivers is helping their loved one work with their treatment team to help find the right treatment plan and encouraging them to stick with it, as non-adherence is a common problem that can increase the risk of relapse. One of the reasons an LAI like Invega Sustenna made sense for Samir was because it is administered by a healthcare professional and removes the need for a daily schizophrenia pill. Still, Queen encourages other caregivers to educate themselves on all the available treatment options, including safety information. Please see the important safety information for Invega Sustenna, including the boxed warning at the bottom of the page. Establish a routine. Structure is crucial for people with schizophrenia. That means adhering to regular mealtimes, sleep, doctor's appointments and medication schedules, and even getting help with basic daily tasks. I'd leave sticky notes around the house for Samir reminding him to brush his teeth, take a shower, or eat, says Queen. Create a supportive environment. You can be non-judgmental and kind without tolerating dangerous or inappropriate behavior. When Samir was agitated in the past, Queen found it helpful to speak to him in an even-toned voice. I'll always try to divert the conversation, she says. I remember holding his hand one time and asking him to think about a vacation we took together. Have a crisis plan in place. When warning signs of a relapse, for example, a return of schizophrenia symptoms arise, such as poor adherence to treatment, substance abuse, and lack of insight into the illness, caregivers need to act quickly. That means having a list of people to call in an emergency. Queen's includes Samir's doctor and two of his social workers. I have their cell phone number, so I know they'll be available to me, she says. Practice self-care. Caregiving can also mean one is overwhelmed with work, lacking sleep, or experiencing financial burdens. Caregivers are especially vulnerable to depression and anxiety, so it's important to make the time for yourself. I do a lot of self-care lately, whether it's meditating, getting a massage at a spa, or planning a weekend getaway, says Queen. I also enjoy listening to music on walks. Lean on friends and loved ones. I have a strong support group of women, says Queen. In addition to my mother and 7 aunts, I have 5 best friends who have been there for me for years. They're my rock. Stay hopeful. Managing any chronic condition is an ongoing process, and schizophrenia is no different. Queen's advice is to hang in there and to ask for help if you need it. I've learned that the greater part of your happiness or misery depends on your disposition, not on your circumstance at the moment, says Queen. It just depends on how you handle it. So there's a little box at the bottom that says, if you or someone else you know has experienced schizophrenic symptoms, seek help. For adult patients who are recently diagnosed or who have tried various treatments, consider speaking with a psychiatric nurse practitioner or other psychiatric professional about LAIs from Johnson & Johnson, like Invega Sustenna. For more information on this medication, visit treatyourschizophrenia.com. This article is from Wholeness. Why every grown woman should try gaming. Sure, you'll bond with your teen, but according to recent research, your brain will thank you too. This article is by Sophia Lodato. When I was 8, I stole my cousin's Nintendo DS, a dual-screen handheld console the size of a small sandwich, and immediately fell in love. My mother was less enamored of my thievery. She wasn't keen on buying her young daughter video games for fear they would completely rot my brain. It wasn't until college and the pandemic that my passion was reignited after a reintroduction to the now ancient DS. Since then, I've logged close to 10,000 hours across video games of all kinds and enjoyed every second. But I, a mostly grown woman, feel unique in this regard. Though we've made strides in the past 20-some years, the majority of gamers, 53% of almost 3 billion, are men. Of the remaining 46%, women over 35 make up a smaller percentage, and rarer still are women over 50, particularly on consoles, on which only some 7% of boomers or the silent generation play. But there's compelling research showing that gaming is good for your brain, and for women's brains in particular. It doesn't just increase your attention span and agility, it also lifts your mood, quells anxiety, and improves social connections. So I propose that we reframe video games for women as powerful tools for mental health, not to mention untapped sources of genuine pleasure and fun. A great therapy tool. Contrary to my mother's belief, video games don't erode your brain. They're actually being used in therapy and treatment for brain cancer, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and strokes, according to Russell Lonzer, MD, professor and chair of the Department of Neurological Surgery at The Ohio State University, and Ryan Douglas, co-founder of DeepWell DTX. DeepWell DTX combines medicine and gaming, called immersive medicine, to reduce stress by stimulating the vagus nerve through games that require breathwork, movement, precision, and rhythm from the player. Games allow us to alter what is happening in your brain without actually having to go into your brain, Douglas explains. In other words, it allows researchers to, usually non-surgically, disrupt unhealthy thought patterns, monitor the way you react to things, or stop the cycle of rumination. When someone is gaming, their brain's data comes at us in real time, says Lonzer. It's personalized, additive, and informative. Through games, we're able to understand if treatment is going well in the moment, if it's going well after the fact, and more, adds Douglas. Tapping a natural high. The reward center in your brain, called the mesolimbic system, releases dopamine in response to hyperarousal or pleasurable experiences, both of which are pretty common when you play. Aside from making you feel good, dopamine helps you maintain your attention and is also self-reinforcing. In other words, the more you experience that hyperarousal, the more dopamine gets released, and the more you may want to return to that behavior. This is part of why video games can become addicting if you're not careful, but more on that later. For someone who struggles with anxiety, games with lots of visual spatial interference, picture Tetris, are amazing for getting you to shut down the self-rumination, says Douglas. And then, that heavily dopaminergic state helps us get you to a place where you might be more available for therapy. That is to say, in measured doses, games act like very short-term antidepressants to kickstart the healing process. If you've experienced loss, skip Tetris and play in a cooperative game, says Douglas, because the emphasis on human connection will help you navigate the feelings of grief. Improved memory and attention. Games do much more to the brain than just that, though. One study from the University of California at Irvine found that playing 3D video games can boost the formation of memories. Gamers improved their memory test scores by 12% after playing a particular 3D game for a few weeks, which, interestingly, is close to the amount that memory performance usually declines in middle and late age. Generally, video game players are also faster and more accurate in decision-making than non-video game players. More specifically, puzzle games, Tetris, Candy Crush, unpacking, can increase performance in perception and recognition, while action games, which usually require the player to complete challenges and battles with hand-eye coordination and quick reaction times, God of War, Assassin's Creed, have been linked with greater attention spans and the ability to filter specific information. Strategy games, on the other hand, often involve long-term planning over immediate action to win. Total War, Civilization. These types of games even have the potential to improve brain function in older adults and may provide a defense against dementia and Alzheimer's disease, which women are more prone to than men. Finding community in co-op. You might think of gamers as isolated and antisocial, but as any mom who has been jolted awake by a gleefully shouting teen in the middle of the night can attest, gaming can facilitate amazing social support and interaction. Multiplayer games like World of Warcraft or even Grand Theft Auto, despite their violent nature, which contrary to popular belief, doesn't cause real-world violence or antisocial behavior, can become virtual social communities. This is the case regardless of how you're interacting, whether it's via online chat with others, playing together with your avatars in the game, or simply doing some couch co-op, gaming side by side with your friend. I treat a lot of brain tumors. Some people want to talk about it all the time. Some people don't want to talk about it all the time, shares Lonzer. A gaming community exposes them to individuals outside of their friends and family, outside of what may be a very narrow circle. It allows them to express themselves in a personalized way in a larger group. More simply, it's a great distraction and allows someone to forge an identity outside of their cancer. And of course, it can be a way to connect with your kids. My favorite games are the ones that made me feel closer to my children, says Douglas. We lived a whole life in Minecraft, and we played together and knew each other in a completely different way. How to keep it healthy. Another negative stereotype, that gaming is addictive. This is the case with anything that releases dopamine and triggers your reward systems, but there's a lot more to it than that. According to Douglas, it has very little to do with what you play and a whole lot more to do with how the situation is monetized. What he means is that a lot of modern games, and online games especially, follow certain social constructs that aren't designed with your interests in mind. Whether that's charging $40 per expansion pack, I'm talking about you, The Sims 4, or allowing for unmoderated and potentially vitriolic chat. It's also important to be aware of why you're gaming. If it's for fun or to blow off a bit of steam, or if you're gaming mindfully, that's fine. But there's a real lack of understanding of when to stop, says Douglas. Once you hit that hiding from problems threshold where your homework is piling up, or you're not addressing an abusive relationship, or you're avoiding your health conditions, that's where you hit that transitional point where gaming is not good for you. So where do I start? Haven't touched a joystick since Ms. Pac-Man at the arcade in the mall? Don't worry. I have more than a few recommendations to reel you back in. I love a good mobile game. Monument Valley, Flow Free, and The Room series are some personal favorites you can download on your phone. They're a great way to dip your toe in, as they don't require a hefty initial investment. But console games are the main focus here, and they will open up an entirely new world for you if you're able to invest. For the total beginner, I recommend picking up the Nintendo Switch. You'll get access to Nintendo's entire repertoire of recent games, many of which are beginner-friendly. If you're looking for something cozy and not plot-heavy, try the Animal Crossing New Horizons, in which you play a character who has just moved to an island that needs a bit of help getting cleaned up. Anything Pokemon-related is also a safe bet, and they feature a turn-based combat system that will introduce you to how to think about combat in games. Both of these are low-stress, low-stakes games, and while simple in gameplay, incredibly fun. For a step up in combat and gameplay, check out Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom of the Legend of Zelda franchise, also on the Switch. Both are utterly masterful games, 3D and puzzle related, and that are as gorgeous to look at as they are fun to play. Each is also a little more plot heavy, getting you emotionally invested in the different characters and their arcs throughout the game. You can also try any in the iconic Super Mario Bros. Franchise. While simple in plot, they're a great introduction to some higher stakes combat. If combat isn't your thing, though, give it a try first, I promise it's fun. Stick with a more narrative game like 12 Minutes or What Remains of Edith Finch. Neither is technically difficult, and they're slightly on the horror side, playing up the suspense while you investigate each area. Another fave is Unpacking, which has no playable characters. Instead, you learn all about the main characters through packing and unpacking her boxes and organizing her rooms. You can also try Tiny Glade if you like to design buildings and don't want to pay over $1,000 for all the Sims 4 expansion packs. For a game that plays like a movie, check out Ghost of Tsushima and Red Dead Redemption 2, available on various consoles like the PlayStation 4 and Xbox. Similar to Zelda, you play as a set character as opposed to a customizable one. In the former, as the last standing samurai during the first Mongol invasion of Japan. In the latter, an outlaw and gang member in the declining Wild West. While these have a real learning curve in terms of combat, each is highly story-driven with compelling lead characters, and both have some of the most visually stunning graphics you will encounter, particularly Ghost of Tsushima, which has made me cry several times. And finally, for a hard game to work toward, try the infamous Dark Souls series, its successors Bloodborne, Sekiro Shadows Die Twice, or Elden Ring, my favorite game despite its many pitfalls, or its 2D side-scroller equivalent, Hollow Knight, my actual favorite game, which has quite literally zero pitfalls. Each of these are lore-heavy, beautifully designed, and some of the most astonishingly creative works of art I've ever seen and been immersed in. And if you're wondering why on earth people love the struggle in these games so much, I like to cite Hidetaka Miyazaki, the creator of the Dark Souls franchise. Hardship is what gives meaning to the experience. Death and rebirth, trying and overcoming. We want that cycle to be enjoyable. In life, death is a horrible thing. In play, it can be something else. We're moving over now to Oprah's printed magazine edition, Let It Go, your guide to a simpler, more serene life, how to de-stress, declutter, recharge, find your center, and finally relax. We're heading over to chapter 3. The first article is called Get Centered. Breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I smile. Dwelling in the present moment, I know this is a wonderful moment. And that quote is by Thich Nhat Hanh. Breathe deep. Taking some time to focus on the breath can do wonders for the body and mind. And this article is by Mark Matusek. It's among the most important physical functions our bodies perform. We do it about 20,000 times a day, and still, somehow, most of us get it wrong. If I had to limit my advice on healthier living to just one tip, it would be to learn to breathe correctly, says Andrew Well, MD, a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine. Chinese and yogic traditions have long extolled the importance of qi or prana, the life forces associated with breath. And science is finally catching up. It turns out that getting more oxygen by simply changing the way we breathe can facilitate healing from a startling number of serious conditions, including chronic pain, atrial fibrillation, asthma, digestive issues, depression, and a wide range of stress-related illnesses. The secret is to return to a more natural pattern of respiration. Newborns come into the world breathing deeply, but as we age, stress can alter that pattern, and many of us start to breathe more shallowly. By adulthood, on average, we're taking 15 to 20 breaths per minute, 3 to 4 times faster than is optimal. Rapid, shallow breathing sends a message to our adrenal glands that we're in fight or flight mode, and they begin pumping out stress hormones like cortisol, explains Brenda Stockdale, director of mind-body medicine at the RC Cancer Centers in Atlanta. And when the body is stressed, it's weakened. Our immune cells normally function like little Pac-Men, Stockdale explains, patrolling for and destroying bacteria and diseased cells before they can multiply. But when cortisol levels are elevated, those immune cells slow down drastically, allowing pathogens and diseased cells to slip by. Here are 3 exercises to help reverse those faulty inhale-exhale habits. Number 1. Diaphragmatic breathing. What it is. Breathing that involves expanding the belly, which gives the lungs room to take in more oxygen. How it can help. Improve circulation, eases stress-related and anxiety disorders. How to start. Lie on your back with your knees bent. Place one hand just below your rib cage and the other on your upper chest. Breathe in slowly through your nose so that your stomach pushes against your lower hand. As you exhale through pursed lips, tighten your abs and let them fall inward. Do this exercise 3 times a day for 5 to 10 minutes, and then gradually increase that amount. Number 2, alternate nostril breathing. What it is. A yogic technique designed to promote relaxation. How it can help. Reduces blood pressure, may have an anti-obesity effect, boosts cognitive function on spatial tasks. How to start. With your right thumb, close your right nostril and inhale slowly through your left nostril. Now close your left nostril with your pinky and ring fingers. Release your thumb and exhale slowly through your right nostril. Keep the right nostril open. Inhale, then close it. Open the left nostril and exhale slowly through the left. That's one round. Start with 3 rounds and add a round each week until you're up to 5. Practice whenever you're feeling stressed out. Number 3, the bellows breath. What it is. An exercise aimed at increasing alertness. How it can help. Provides a boost in energy comparable to the high you feel after a workout. How to start. With your mouth closed, inhale and exhale quickly and evenly through your nose. Aim for 3 in-out cycles per second, but stop after 15 seconds on your first attempt. Keep practicing, increasing your time by 5 seconds until you reach a minute. When you feel your energy dipping, try this technique for 60 seconds. This next article is Sit Right Down and Start Right Here. Want to meditate? Start with the simple 4-step plan from Andy Pudicombe, creator of the popular app Headspace. Number 1, sit comfortably upright on a chair, feet on the floor, hands resting on your thighs. If you prefer, you can sit on the floor. Take 2 or 3 deep breaths, then close your eyes. Number 2, starting from the top of your head and moving down, mentally scan your body, noticing any tension in your muscles, places of comfort or discomfort, the feel of the floor beneath your feet. Begin to pay attention to the natural rhythm of your breath. Number 3, as you become more aware of your breath, follow the rising and falling sensation without changing it in any way, silently counting breaths. Inevitably, your mind will wander. This is one of the first lessons of meditation. When you notice that a thought has distracted you, let go of it and gently return your attention to your breathing. Over time, you'll learn to step back and just observe the thoughts. The same goes for sounds. Rather than trying to block them out, let them come and go. Number 4. Take a few seconds to allow your mind to do whatever it wants. You may find your mind is very quiet, noticing the sounds around you and bringing your attention back to the body. Gently open your eyes. And then there's a notation attached with this, when to do it. Many people meditate first thing in the morning to start the day with a clear head, but everyone is different, so find what works for you. How often? The more you practice, the more quickly you'll see benefits, but quality matters more than quantity, so focus on little and often, taking time to build a strong foundation. If doing it every day is too much, start with 3 to 5 times a day. How long? For beginners, 10 minutes a day will suffice. Use a timer or an app so you won't have to watch the clock. For some people, that will always be enough, but eventually you may decide to sit for longer periods, especially once you begin to feel the awesomeness of your newfound headspace. Moving on in the printed magazine, the next article is Om Sweet Om, the science-backed benefits of meditation from your brain to your bowels and beyond. Number 1, makes you nicer. When Buddhist monks practiced compassion meditation while having their brains scanned, we've all done that, right? They showed increased neural activity related to empathy. Number 2, reunites you with your car keys. Memory training exercises? Sure. Or if you could meditate / visualize / yoga your way to improved cognition, according to a small study of older adults. Number 3, turns your frown upside down. Meditation curbs activity in the brain's amygdala, which helps govern anxiety, stress, and anger. Number 4, provides TLC for your IBS. In one study, 8 weeks of mindfulness-based stress reduction tempered tummy turbulence by a whopping 26.4%. Number 5, slashes your dessert budget. Mindfulness stokes self-control and, by helping you distance yourself from cravings, robs Boston cream pie of its dastardly allure. Number 6, transports you to Margaritaville. Meditation turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, the flip side of fight or flight. Blood pressure drops, umbrella drink mode kicks in. Number 7, sweetens your slumber. After a 6-week meditation workshop, insomniacs felt better rested and less depressed, probably because they were better rested and less depressed. Number 8, douses the flames shooting out of your head. Multiple studies have shown that mindfulness yoga and deep breathing have a chilling effect on hot flashes. Number 9, soothes your achy, breaky back. 8 weeks of mindfulness training for nearly 5 months of relief? Sign us up. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This next article is Beyond the Breath. Want to mix up your meditation practice? Try these boredom-busting alternatives. Number 1, if you're goal-oriented, try guided imagery. What it is. You follow a script that helps you home in on a specific intention, getting to sleep, conquering fear, boosting self-esteem. What you'll do. For fear, you might progressively relax various parts of the body, starting with your toes, moving up to your ankles, and so on. For inner strength, you might imagine being a tall mountain. Give it a whirl. Chopra.com, that's spelled C-H-O-P-R-A. Tarabrach.com, that's T-A-R-A-B-R-A-C-H.com. John Kabat-Zinn on YouTube. And that's spelled J-O-N, and then the next name is K-A-B-A-T, and then / Z-I-N-N. If woo-woo is a no-no, try open focus. What it is. Developed in the 1990s by psychologist Les Femi, Ph.D., based on his EEG biofeedback research, open focus directs your attention not to a breath or a mantra, but to empty spaces. In turn, your brain produces slow, calming alpha waves. It's less complicated than it sounds. What you'll do, imagine the space between your eyes or inside your ears. Give it a whirl at openfocus.com. Number 3, if you're feeling warm and fuzzy or just the opposite, try loving kindness. What it is. Sending compassionate thoughts to yourself and others. What you'll do. First, wish yourself well with the phrases, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe, may I be at ease. Then repeat the process, thinking first of someone you respect, then someone you love, then a stranger, then someone who's hurt you. Give it a whirl when you're feeling really grateful when you've had a fight with your teenager. Number 4, if you have ants in your pants, try walking meditation. What it is. Mindfulness while you walk. What you'll do. Embrace the sensation of each foot as you lift it and put it down again. Feel the pressure of your soles, the touch of your shoes against your skin. Notice your surroundings, what you see, hear, smell. When you stop, feel what it's like to be still. Give it a whirl. On your lunch hour, in a lush forest, in the parking lot at Target. Moving on to the next article, what do we want? Inner peace. When do we want it? Now. We asked top meditation and mindfulness pros for their best on-the-spot, do-anywhere tension-taming techniques. This article is by Kim Trinnell. Count your breaths. Best for surviving red alert emergencies. By forcing yourself to breathe as you do in your most relaxed moments, you trick your body into releasing calming neurohormones, causing a biological shift in how you feel, says psychotherapist Bella Ruth Napperstek. Just inhale and feel your abdomen expand. Go as slowly as possible, counting in One, two, three. Then observe the turn of your breath and breathe it out. One, two, three. Whether you do this for 1 minute or five, it's going to bring you to a calmer place. Flex and release. Best for letting go of work tension. Start by clenching the muscles in your forehead and face as you take a breath and hold it for a moment, says Nina Smiley, PhD, co-author of The 3-Minute Meditator. As you release the tension, exhale fully and relax. Work your way down your body, repeating the process. The tightening and releasing is a physical cue to your body to let stress go. Be here now. Best for combating worst-case scenario anxiety. Our minds are constantly in the past or the future. We'll ruminate on what's too late to change or catastrophize about what hasn't happened yet, says Diana Winston, a director at the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center and co-author of Fully Present. But the more you practice coming back to the present, the less anxious you'll feel. For example, when I wash dishes, instead of letting my mind wander to all my worries, I really try to show up and pay attention to the sensation of the task, the water, the heat, the plate in my hand. You can do this in the shower or even when brushing your teeth. No one says you have to meditate with your eyes closed. Take smoke breaks without the smoking. Best for coping with chronic stress. In a way, smokers have the right idea, says Julian Ford, PhD, professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and co-author of Hijacked by Your Brain. When they step outside to light up, they're doing one of the most important and hardest parts of de-stressing, taking a break. They consciously distance themselves from immediate pressures and remove themselves from all the cues that say, work harder. This naturally turns down the alarm in their brain. Happily, you don't have to engage in dangerous behavior like smoking to do this. Simply walking away from stressors for a few minutes can be one of the best practices for learning to handle daily pressure. How to quiet your inner worriers. I call them the Greek chorus. Those voices that whisper and wail at every turn. You can't evict them, but you can shush them. First, I picture them as little mice in Babe chirping, this will not end well. Not so scary after all. Then I do a reality check. Who's being a little dramatic here? And just like that, I dismiss them. Everyone's approach is different. I have one friend who imagines his fears are a yapping dog. As he pats and soothes the dog, his fears slowly dissipate. Another pretends she's collecting her worries in a garbage bag. Then she tosses them in the trash compactor. Squished! When you focus, it's amazing how quickly you can clean house. From Patty Chang, anchor, author. This next article is The New Nature Walk. Japanese researchers have found that leaving the civilized world behind for a few hours could be the healthiest thing you do all day. This article is by Nicole Frese. One summer, Rebecca Valentine was feeling the way we all have at some point, overworked, dog-tired, and a bit panicky. She had just quit her job as a community outreach coordinator to strike out on her own and open a souvenir shop in her hometown of Santa Rosa, California. I knew I'd made the right move, but I was still freaked out about starting my own business, she recalls. So when a friend asked her to join him on a guided 3-hour walk in a nearby forest, she agreed, thinking she could use the distraction. This wasn't just any hike in the woods, however. Valentine was taking part in a practice called Shinrin Yoku, which translates as forest bathing or luxuriating in the woods. We really focused on what we were seeing, hearing, and smelling, says Valentine. It helped keep my mind off work. Your average walk in the park may help you relax a little, but Shinrin Yoku, developed in Japan in the 1980s, requires participants to deliberately engage with nature using all 5 senses. Portions of the walks are often done in silence and cell phone use is discouraged. I encourage walkers to practice deep breathing and to tune in to what sparks their senses, like the texture of birch bark or the scent of wildflowers or pine cones, says Mark Ellison, who began teaching Shinrin-yoku classes 5 years ago at Cabarrus College of Health Sciences in Concord, North Carolina. By combining mindfulness and spending time in nature, two activities that have restorative properties on their own, Shinrin-yoku can yield significant health advantages. A study conducted across 24 forests in Japan found that when people strolled in a wooded area, their levels of the stress hormone cortisol plummeted almost 16% more than when they walked in an urban environment, and the effects were quickly apparent. Subjects' blood pressure showed improvement after about 15 minutes of the practice. But one of the biggest benefits may come from breathing in chemicals called phytoncides emitted by trees and plants. Women who logged 2 to 4 hours in a forest on two consecutive days saw a nearly 40% surge in the activity of cancer-fighting white blood cells, according to one study. Phytoncide exposure reduces stress hormones, indirectly increasing the immune system's ability to kill tumor cells, says Tokyo-based researcher Xing Li, MD, PhD, who has studied Shinrin-yoku even if you don't live near a forest. Studies suggest that just looking at green space, say the trees outside your office windows, helps reduce muscle tension and blood pressure. Veteran wilderness guide Amos Clifford, who leads the walks that Rebecca Valentine attends in California, knows just how healing Shinrin-yoku can be. His blood pressure has dropped 10 points since he began forest bathing. What we do doesn't seem in any way extraordinary, but the effects are astonishing, he says. Back over in digital Oprah, we have the Ninja Creamy Deluxe 11-in-1 Ice Cream and Frozen Treat Maker under Oprah's Favorite Things. If you scream for ice cream or sorbet, slushies, gelato, Italian ice, frozen yogurt, then this handy device is for you. Just 3 steps to a creamy sweet treat. It's $250 at Amazon if you're interested in purchasing that. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.